think I'll do when I give this class is the class before this. At the end, I'll ask devotees to, at least a few devotees who agree to it, to prepare a reading from the Prabhupada Lilamrita, something that they particularly like, and then be prepared to speak on it afterwards for about, the whole thing for about 5 minutes. But we won't have that ready tonight. So it'll be a little experimental, see how our time goes, and see if I do have time for that kind of reading also. I'm mostly going to tell about how the Prabhupada Lilamrita was written. It's kind of an inside story of this, how the biography was written, and I hope to be appreciating Prabhupada through this discussion of the biography. This is like an extension of our previous talk, Memorials, How to Keep the Memory Alive. In fact, we mentioned Prabhupada Lilamrita as biography and memoir literature. And so, as we said about memorials in general, Prabhupada didn't ask for a biography. He said, oh, there's so many books about gurus. Give us many books about Krishna. But this was one of those things that he did give permission of, like the Murti, while he was still alive. My first thinking or hearing about a biography, at least in connection with my having something to do with it, was when Prabhupada first became seriously ill and was calling the devotees to see him, 1977. May, that was, when one of the devotees in the BTG office where I worked in L.A., Drubada Prabhu, said that, you know, we should start thinking about writing a biography of Srila Prabhupada, and while he's still with us, consult him about it. So I wrote to his secretary asking about it, and I knew there had been some previous reluctance on Prabhupada's part. And then he wrote back, that letter I can't locate, where he said that, yes, Prabhupada said it could be done. I explained to him what you had said, what I had said. I said, you know, explain it to him nicely. We don't just want a quick rejection. Say that it would be spiritual, just like Chaitanya Charitamrita is about Lord Chaitanya. It would have a spiritual treatment. So he said, yes, he liked the idea, and he said that you should do it. So then I wrote again with some more queries. At that time, Prabhupada wasn't answering letters, and I got this letter back from Tamal Krishna Goswami. Now, these letters were valuable because he often included things Prabhupada said. I have your letter of July 22nd, 1977, regarding the writing of a biography of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Today I spoke further to His Divine Grace about the biography, explaining to him that your good self wanted to take it up personally and write it. I mentioned to His Divine Grace that this book would trace all the wonderful transcendental activities of how he developed ISKCON throughout the world. There was no difficulty for information since Srila Prabhupada came to America, but naturally it is difficult for us to know things previous to his coming here. So I mentioned that just as when Shyama Sundar Prabhu would sit with His Divine Grace sometime each day, whenever it was convenient, to ask various questions for the philosophy book. So would it be all right if Satsvarup Maharaj were to compile some very nice questions which I could ask Your Divine Grace about? Your early days, Srila Prabhupada was quite agreeable to this, and in fact he immediately began to speak of his early childhood days, mentioning among other things that in his maternal uncle's house he used to be called Nanda Dulal on account of being born on Nandotsava day. So I simply await your questions. Now I have a full-time assistant, secretary. I'll be pleased to take part in the writing of this glorious book by being the interviewer. But that was as far as it ever went, that one spontaneous talk where Prabhupada said some things. I sent many questions, but they were never asked because he was became too ill. But the important thing was the permission and the blessing. There was also something he said about his biography, which I later learned from Giriraj Swami. There was some book in India was doing an anthology with little biographical sketches on Swamis in India. So Prabhupada was asked if he would take part in it. And he said to Giriraj Swami, well, he said, if there's to be a biography written, he said, about me, it should say like this, that I brought Krishna consciousness to the West, to America, and compare it to taking a tulsi and transplanting it. And if you take a tulsi and transplant it, it's very delicate and you have to be very careful. It's difficult and to do it successfully so that it will grow. So say that I did that. I transplanted Krishna consciousness from India to the West. So that was like a briefly what he wanted to be done. In his biography. So, I'll tell you a little bit about how the biography was formed. Recently I saw a book which was compiled of six different biographers telling about how they wrote their biographies, and so there's apparently some interest in this. There's certainly interest in biography. It's a very popular form of literature in bookstores and libraries. Plenty of books and always being written, more and more. So people like to hear also sometimes about how the biographies are written. And what so what decisions had to be made to go into this book. I began in 1978. I read all of Prabhupada's letters and started thinking, what am I going to do? And one of the things I did was research about biography, not so much reading biographies, but anything I could about the art of biography. And then I went to find about religious and spiritual biography and Vaishnav biography. And of course, pretty soon I knew that I wanted to write for the devotees, but I wanted to also write for the non-devotees to tell them about Prabhupada. And that's one of the reasons we want to preserve the memory. So that's a real trick, so to speak, to write for both audiences. Therefore, I was interested when I saw that people in general, in especially, say, the last century, they've become disinclined to a type of biography about saints or spiritual persons, which is called hagiography. If you look in the dictionary, it probably means something like lives of saints. But usually, they're very devoted. But as far as being like scientific researched writings, that they're usually not. And they're usually, legend is mixed in a lot with what actually happened without distinguishing one from the other. The purpose is to increase the faith of the faithful and to glorify the person. But it often has an effect on people who aren't really completely already very, very faithful, that they think, well, this doesn't sound authentic. So especially, let's say, in the last 100 years or so, these works are regarded very suspiciously. So, and not just by non-believers, but by religious people. Now, religious biography is also written more as with the fulfilling the scientific demands and glorifying, in our case, Prabhupada. So I thought, yes, I should try to do that, write a modern biography about a modern saint in a way that modern people will also accept it. not to write Prabhupada as if he were an ordinary man with material motives. Just to talk a little bit more about biography and how, the kind of biography that we, of course, wouldn't write. There's the tendency also has become to debunk the people that the person you write about, or to tell what they call the whole story. And that also didn't used to be done. Biography used to be, in previous centuries, biographies would be written about great people and they would be praised. But in the literary history, there was one particular biographer who started it all off. His name was Linton Strachey. And he wrote a book in 1918 called Eminent Victorians, in which he wrote about Queen Victoria and another great person, whose name slips my mind. And he debunked them and got, instead of just telling the public image, he found out all kinds of things about them and made disclosures. And this is like set the trend, and now all biographies are like that nowadays. And there's one biographer who's very prominent. He's a biographer of the American writer Henry James. His name is Leon Edel. And he has a theory that you have to find out, demythologize. So there's some myth about a person, but behind it, like under the rug, there's something that is like just the opposite, and usually to the discredit of the more favorable image. So, like he gave the example that Ernest Hemingway is, the myth about him is that he's very manly, very tough, macho. But he says if you really study his life, you see he has a real inferiority complex about that very thing. And he's not like that, but he's just putting up a front. So like if somebody reads that, wow, everything gets turned around upside down. And he also said, by his research of Henry David Thoreau, that the whole thing about his staying and walled in and wanting to be alone, it was just because he never grew up. He was just a child. He never grew up to an adult, and he was had like a child complex. And he went so far as to say that he cheated on saying how long he stayed at Walden. He really didn't stay there that long. Of course, Thoreau scholars, they don't accept this either. But I was horrified to read this kind of thing, and I certainly knew that I wasn't going to do anything like that about Prabhupada. And also, the thing about, and the idea is that people are complex and they have many sides, and that it's simplistic to just say the image. But actually, Prabhupada didn't have complicated motives. However, Prabhupada does go beyond our vision, but only in the sense that we can't understand it, the depth of his purity. In that sense, we try to go deeper and deeper to understand, and we can never understand. But in terms of like most people and how now the way biographies are written, like they'll present that they've always got some mixed motive. If somebody wants to be a leader in a country, it's not just because he wants to help the people, but he wants to do this and he wants to do that, because people have mixed motives and they're complicated. But Prabhupada's not like that. So avoiding these different things, it began to help understand what I wanted to do. I wanted to make him human-like, believable to everybody, but his transcendental position always established, and nothing like I mentioned. So there are many decisions to be made, even a simple decision like whether to write from the beginning of his life to the end. Many biographies, they start right away talking about the person as he was later, as he was great. And the biographers, they even debate about it, you know, which way to write. But I follow the theory that life actually unravels or evolves starting when you're born, and you don't really know what's coming in the future, and you just start to live your life as a baby and a child, and you grow up, and it should be just chronologically in order. So we did the Prabhupada Lilamrita in that way, resisting the other other theory. I was impressed by one criticism of the theory where you just jump in and start describing him when it's great, and it's that the biographer, he tends to become so much the controller of the person's life that he's shaping everything. He said the person becomes consumed by the biographer. So I tried to just follow Prabhupada as best I could. Someone was reading the biography. He said, "Oh, it's just like we're perched on Prabhupada's shoulder and we're seeing all the things he's doing." So, by the different information I had, just like Prabhupada started telling about his childhood, I tried to be there, starting with his birth and growing older, instead of this dominant controller method. Another thing to avoid, and which is also very strictly followed by biographers nowadays, is not to employ any mind-reading fiction, to fictionalize, which means you don't really know what happened, but you make up either big things or even details. And it's like, when you do that, your biography becomes unscientific. In this book where biographers were telling about their art, there was an interesting comment by one man who was asked a question about the role of conjecture in his biography. And he was asked, "Can you talk about the limits and ethics of conjecture in writing a biography?" And he said, "I have nothing against conjecture, as long as the biographer makes it clear that it is conjecture. The temptation is to fictionalize, to impute motives that can't be documented, to dress up a scene or a character or an episode with details that might work in a novel, but have no basis in fact, such as Emily," he's a biographer of Emily Dickinson, "such as Emily stood looking out the window. As Emily stood looking out the window, a tear ran down her cheek." So, some people think even that I did this, but I was very careful, tried not to. Sometimes, however, when you get a lot of information, you can set a scene just like it was. Say I was describing Prabhupada taking a train ride from Delhi to Vrindavan. So you can find out what it was like in that year that he did it and describe the scenery. And I could say that at that time of his life he had given up his wife and he wasn't worried anymore about supporting his family. Now he was going to dedicate his life to Krishna. So you can say what he saw out the window. You could say at that time of his life how he was thinking in general or what his purpose was. But you can say that when the train passed such and such station, that he thought of such and such, unless you have that documented. So there are a lot of lifelike created scenes in the Prabhupada Lilamrita, but I think if you look at them closely, you won't find that kind of thing, except maybe in a few places. So certainly we wanted the book to be well documented, and we had such a good facility of a team of workers. Now, so spiritual biographies have their special needs and standards, unlike the other biographers. And one of them is that they have to have a invocation, and the invocation has specific elements. And this was described by Krishnadas Kaviraj in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So I tried to follow that. According to Krishnadas Kaviraj, an invocation involves 1, obeisances; 2, defining the objective; and 3, bestowing benedictions. So I wrote this in one of the introductions. For obeisances, I offer obeisances to Srila Prabhupada and the disciplic succession. I'm praying that he will allow me to surmount the difficulties involved in presenting his biography and that he will be pleased with the result. I'm convinced by his good wishes the work can be successful, and if he is not pleased, I am powerless to write anything of merit. That's offer obeisances in this case to Prabhupada himself. Objective. The objective of Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is to present the life and teachings of Srila Prabhupada in the transcendental perspective, never portraying him as an ordinary man subject to the modes of nature. Srila Prabhupada was a divinely empowered pure devotee. He was sent to this world by the Supreme Lord just to spread Krishna consciousness movement to people of all nations, races, classes, and creeds. Another objective of this work is to attract the leaders and influential members of society who appreciate and love Srila Prabhupada. The biography must be honest, factual, and correct in transcendental knowledge, and it must captivate and please the reader. Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita must enlighten and please and also move the reader to inquire into the writings of Srila Prabhupada. Ultimate objective is that the reader be further moved to take up the service of His Divine Grace, Prabhupada. And then offering benedictions. The writer is supposed to offer benedictions. I am fallen and cannot offer any benedictions, but I confidently assure my readers that by reading the life and teachings of Srila Prabhupada, they will gain quick access to the mercy of Krishna, because they will get the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. Those who knew Prabhupada will have their memories refreshed and rededicate themselves. Those who never knew Prabhupada will be blessed by his association. So as the, I wrote First Planting the Seed, the second volume, because I felt best and most familiar with that material, 1966. And for such a job as this, I wanted to start in with something I felt more confident about. And so I showed the manuscript to reliable devotees, and they were always very encouraging. And the published books were appreciated, but there were some criticisms, and I mostly defended the published work of different criticisms that came, which I can mention. Some people maybe thought that I did treat Prabhupada as ordinary or other different things. People will always have something they find to say about it. But it was generally well received. So I'll tell a little bit about some of the detective work and some of the putting of it together. Another point brought up by biographers was that you have to get close to the subject and you live with him. I was reading one man, he wrote about this social commentator and columnist, Walter Lippmann, and he said when he really started getting into the research, he said, I felt that in an insidious way, Walter Lippmann was taking over my control of my life. And another biographer, he got so angry with the subject, the more he learned about her, that he just wanted to stop, couldn't stand her. So you do get very intimate. Someone said, you know, you get up every morning and you're living with that subject. So he said, someone said, it should really has to be somebody who's got a lot of vitality so that you can keep living with him and being encouraged. Some compare it to a marriage. So it's an intimate relationship. But in the case of being able to become intimate with Prabhupada, it's a great blessing. And at different times we felt that Prabhupada was helping us, or we were coming close to Prabhupada. And that was at a time just after his disappearance, when it was especially important to have something like that, which was service to him. Now, I have some notes about field work in Vrindavan. You have to go to the field. That's another injunction about biography. This biographer of Harry Truman said, to write about Harry Truman, you have to go to Jackson County, Missouri. You have to live there and know it. So, I especially did field work for the first volume, for India. As indicated in that letter by Tamal Krishna Maharaj, it would be the early years that would be require the most research. Other things were well known. But we may take it for granted now that Volume 1 is out, about the order of things that happened, but nobody knew these things. And we had to find them out, when Prabhupada left his home and how he went to the Gaudiya Math and what something about Jhansi and then this and this and this. So hardly any of it was very well known. So a lot of research was done in India by a whole team, especially about half a dozen devotees. And in that spirit of telling about the sleuthing work and the field work of biography, in hopes that will be interesting, I wrote down some of it in an essay about going to Vrindavan for that purpose. And I just read some sections of it. I'd gone to Vrindavan for a specific mission of service for writing the biography of Srila Prabhupada. My attitude was to serve in the Dham and to learn submissively from its residents. My first night of Vrindavan, I had a dream in which Prabhupada told me it was right to concentrate exclusively on writing. In Prabhupada's presence, I articulated a full question about my different obligations and the priority of writing. In the dream, Prabhupada replied spontaneously, approving the writing intentions. Our mission was a very particular one. Although Prabhupada was readily accessible in the magnificence of his ISKCON temple, I had come to try to understand Prabhupada before he went to the West, when there was no Krishna Balaram temple. So I was staying in the temple, but I almost didn't want to see the temple. I wanted to go out and see and try to imagine what it was like before he was there. Different Prabhupada, the earlier Prabhupada. This was a time when it might seem superficially that Prabhupada was a smaller, lesser figure than Prabhupada before he came to America. Of course, he was not actually lesser. Yet I had to sense his particular greatness at that time when he was alone in Vrindavan with no followers, only his plans for a worldwide movement, when he was writing and absorbed in Vrindavan. These seemed to be the ingredients for a good attitude while in Vrindavan. To be happy within the structure of ISKCON and yet to be intent on a particular service or objective to be carried out while staying in the Dham. The men working with me, Shesha, Kundali, and Baladev, all set out for the Mats of Vrindavan to seek out God brothers and old associates of Prabhupada. Quickly the pieces of the puzzle began to come together as to the details of Prabhupada's life, exactly how much time he spent residing at the temple in Keshigat, when he moved to Radhadamodar temple, the sequence of writing and producing his books, and so on. Our tape recording and transcendental sleuthing went on with the cooperation of devotees and friends who gave suggestions of persons to see and places to visit for more information about Bhaktivedanta Swami. Again, one biographer I was reading, he wrote about Lyndon Johnson, and he went back to the very backward, humble setting where he lived in Texas, and to find out what it was like, he interviewed women who showed him what it was like when they used to haul a bucket of water from the well, and he did it himself and saw how heavy it was and got into it, as we say. So we all did that too. We went to all these little places to see how books were put together in a very primitive way in India, and walked the exact places that Prabhupada walked, tried to take the same turns he did and see the things that he did, especially, and trying to understand that Vrindavan. Of course, Vrindavan doesn't change so quickly, so it wasn't so hard to imagine Vrindavan 1950. In addition to interviewing, I went on walks for gathering descriptive details and for trying to understand, in some small way at least, what it was like when Srila Prabhupada walked there. At first, I was bewildered by the external aspects of the Dham. The picture of Prabhupada that began to emerge from our interviews was mostly a solitary figure, although very pleasant and saintly, always writing his books and articles and moving to and from Vrindavan. Yes, they had heard from him his plan to go to the West, but they could hardly believe it. From what I knew of Prabhupada's inconceivable greatness, I tried to appreciate his vision to go to the West and distribute books, even while he was living peacefully here in Vrindavan. I had to see to some small degree how he lived here and how the order of his spiritual master was speaking to him day and night. I had to visualize how Prabhupada moved in different places throughout India, printing his books privately, doing everything alone, and finding very little reception from his countrymen. Although at that time no one knew whether Prabhupada's dreams would be successful, now we know that he was being called by a genuine promise and that he succeeded beyond all good expectations, not only in getting permission to leave India and distribute a few books, but in creating a worldwide movement of dedicated followers of Krishna. This kind of meditation on Prabhupada's early life in Vrindavan was beneficial not only for his biographer, but for any devotee coming to Vrindavan. For all followers of Krishna consciousness movement, the village of Vrindavan is integrally connected with the eternal significance of Vrindavan, as well as its ancient and medieval history, but Vrindavan is also the place of the Leela of Prabhupada's residence. I go on saying about how I tried to get in the mood of the Radha Damodar temple, staying there overnight, and thinking how Prabhupada worked there. I tried to trace and present Prabhupada's presence in Vrindavan to the perception of every detail and experience. Just as a scientist learns more about the subject of his investigation by his close, studied perception, so a devotee by thoughtful receptivity can gain a greater appreciation of the Dham. I was especially keen to understand how Prabhupada wrote in his little room within the Radha Damodar temple. This was a safe place because it was permeated with Prabhupada's presence and mission. He had written in a letter that in hot weather he used to shut the doors to this little room and run the electric fan. He had said that during the times of intense Vrindavan heat it required strength of mind. I was never a lazy man, he had said. I noted that the stones on the floor of Prabhupada's room were big sandstone squares, the same as those in front of Rupa Goswami's samadhi. The cot in Prabhupada's room with its wooden legs and rope, quote, mattress, unquote, was not the original cot that he used, but I could assume it was something like that. When Prabhupada was here, were there sometimes squealing children? Did the women approach the deity with cracked, emotional voices? When he was here, were the aartis to Damodar conducted with clanging bells and the whomping and clashing of cartels? After the aarti, did the pujari call out, Radha Damodar ki jai, etc.? As I sat within the room, I realized there were many things about Prabhupada's presence in Vrindavan that I could never imagine or understand. At least I could think of him in awe, how he worked here, preparing to deliver salvation to all humankind. So it's not that you capture someone like Prabhupada, but you follow his footsteps and pick up the different traces and documents his movements. So that's about that, about that work in Vrindavan. That volume one was a real high point, and then coming back here to Gita Nagari where I wrote it, and Shesha was here too, and during the day we would gather all the things together, and I'd say a lot of it was detective work and trying to understand motives of different people. And then early in the morning, get up and with that material ready, write it. And it was a very nice meditation. This book was produced by many people who worked and typed up, did typing, and they're all mentioned in the acknowledgments. And researching. One of the most important resources was Prabhupada's statements. Although we were disappointed that he didn't speak in 1977 about his childhood, it turned out that it really wasn't that important that he do so because he had done so all throughout his life. So it was just a matter of finding on all the lectures and conversations and some purports all the things that he said about his early life. And when we put it together, there was a lot. So I don't really have a feeling that something was missed by not sitting down with him in 1977, because he gave so much already in different talks. So his statements are very important. and interviews, of course. The interviews, they had to be done also scientifically, and those devotees I mentioned, they got to be quite expert at it, because people would often tell things that weren't true, and you had to practically know as much or more than they did when you sat and talked with them, and then you go and talk to somebody else. There are so many people we would see in India, and they say, "Oh yes, Swamiji, it was I who told him to go to India, to America. I told him, and I gave him the money to go, and he wrote me many letters." And you think, "Oh, this sounds like a story." So there are many people who claim that just that they paid Prabhupada's fare to go, and they told him to go. But the more we researched, a lot of things like that proved to be untrue. So you had to be really careful to develop an extra sense to understand when somebody was really telling the truth. Therefore, so the things that we took from Prabhupada and from the interviews, we decided to use some of them just verbatim, instead of writing them in as the author of the biography, to put them in there. This is called the technique of oral biography, that you just let people talk for themselves in the book. We did that in italics. And that was appreciated, particularly in one introduction by Harvey Cox. He liked the oral history. He said about it, "In a few years, all these people will have passed on. Those sources will be lost, at least to our mortal ears, forever. It is extremely important that the writer use this method and use it very skillfully. I hope others will use it as effectively." So, returning to that one, that basic concept was to present Prabhupada as Nitya Siddha, but to show his actual struggles as we human beings saw him. So, some people, they said, "Well, if I would have written a biography, I would have shown that Prabhupada was more transcendental." Someone criticized, "Oh, look, you said that Prabhupada dozed. But he's from the spiritual world. How could he doze? That's what an ordinary person does." Or you say he felt tired. Prabhupada couldn't feel tired. But the description of the Nitya Siddha in the Bhagavatam is, or CC, "By the order of the Supreme, the Nitya Siddha remains within this material world like an ordinary man, but his only business is to broadcast the glories of the Lord. All Nitya Siddhas within this material world may appear to toil like ordinary men, but they never forget their position as the servants of the Lord." And Prabhupada states about that quote, "When we consider Prabhupada's identity as Lord Krishna's empowered..." Oh, I wrote. "When we consider Prabhupada's identity as Lord Krishna's empowered representative, the years of struggle described in this volume take on a special sweetness. These years reveal little-known events in the life of a person who was always wrapped in devotional remembrance of Krishna. Although he struggled through many hardships, his struggles were not those of an ordinary man, for he lived solely to carry out the will of Guru and Krishna. I invite the reader to enjoy the very real human life story of Srila Prabhupada." I think the treatment that's actually speculative is the too miraculous treatment of Prabhupada, where people speculate and thinking that to praise him, they have to describe that he's always defying material laws. And they speculate like that, describing as if Prabhupada was the physically strongest man in the world, and they saw this, the way he lift up a book, and he lifted it up so easily, and you could tell that. This is speculative, not the way to write him as he appears, but with the understanding of his transcendental presence. However, we did include incidents that Prabhupada revealed his actual spiritual nature. Someone mentioned the other night how Prabhupada saved the Radhakrishna deities when the altar was collapsing in London. So we described that not these things not just in an ordinary way, but brought out by the devotees' viewpoints and other ways, the spiritual nature of these things. But aware always that we didn't want to frighten the non-devotees by too much hagiography. So, just a brief note on how the Prabhupada Lilamrita, this resource, can be used. Obviously, we can't remember all the Leelas, and so we have the book form, Kali Yuga, resource. Devotees can read the books, not just one time, but they can read a little bit regularly. There's one devotee who from the very beginning was, he was like a mad bee after the honey of the Prabhupada Lilamrita. It was Shivaram Swami. When he knew I was writing, he would come here and just stay here for weeks. And we used to be very private about our files, not want to show anyone. I wouldn't show anyone the files. I want to speak of anyone taking anything out of the room. So he would come and then he would say, can I just see them? Can I just sit over there and read them? And he was so sincere about it that we used to let him do it. And he would spend long hours just reading and reading. And then when the books came out, he loved them. And to this day, I just wrote him for the, say, do you still read the Prabhupada Lilamrita? And he wrote me this letter back. I read the Prabhupada Lilamrita continually. When I finish it, then I start over again from the beginning. Sometimes I read the series. Before I take rest at night, I get someone to read to me 15, 20, or 30 minutes from the book. I consider it to be an integral part of my relationship with Srila Prabhupada. I personally have not had all these experiences with him, neither has any one single individual, but here is a unique opportunity where I can associate with Srila Prabhupada through his whole manifest appearance and learn of his behavior, activities, consciousness, and vision on various matters. In Srila Prabhupada's absence, it is a substantial means for me to associate with him and continue hearing about him. It can also be used as a research for special events like Vyas Pooj or Bhakti Sananda Saraswati's appearance day. You can pull things out of it. You can research different topics of Prabhupada from the indexes, especially if you want to write essays. For the non-devotees, it's a mass distribution item. This book has been widely distributed. On the regular Sankirtan and libraries. So that should be done by the BBTs of all the different countries. They gradually all have been translating this book. I have a collection of so many wonderful books. There's one in Czechoslovakian and Russian and more and more different languages, the one volume. They tend to do this, and then many of these countries, they don't have all the Bhagavatams even, so they do this pretty early, but they don't do these. But they're in Portuguese language. The Brazil BBT is very enthusiastic to get these all out. But they did it, and I don't know of any other country that's really done it all. So now I've got some questions, and then can ask you for questions and comments. Let's see. Oh, here's one. Could it be said that biographies and memoirs of Srila Prabhupada by his followers are biased? And to go with this, I have a comment from this book about biographers. This biographer of Harry Truman talks about one particular book. He said about Truman, he says, there's a very good book that his daughter Margaret wrote, a delightful book, but it is nonetheless written by an adoring and loyal and partisan member of the family. So you see, it's like a minimizing attitude. So, what about that? How would you answer that? Can a biography be written by his followers that's actually objective, or are they like disqualified from writing? Anyone want to? Ganeshakti.
It would seem that a certain perspective like that could have some validity. Just like someone may see, standard analogy, someone may see the president as a, from a family standpoint, someone may see him as an aide, or someone may see him as a citizen.
Right.
So it would seem that there's a place for that. Maybe that it couldn't be regarded as a universal overview, but at least a certain perspective.
Hmm. To sympathize with what you said, we do, when we see ISKCON, for example, praised by a scholar, we get like this book that's come out, Charles Brooks, about the Hare Krishnas in India, really getting lively. Boy, this is really going to convince people, because he's not even a devotee, and he's writing so favorably. But that's not the whole story. Yes.
I can't really imagine anybody else really writing about Prabhupada, you know, the way either a disciple or a follower of his, because so much of his life was an internal and transcendental. He's not an ordinary person. But I don't think somebody else could really capture the depth of Prabhupada's life.
Yeah. Except a devotee. I wrote in the preface, to say that the Prabhupada Lilamrita is an authorized biography does not mean that it is a flattering portrait commissioned by an official body, but that it is an authorized literature presented by one who is serving the order of Krishna and Guru through the disciplic succession. Prabhupada Lilamrita is not written from the mundane or speculative viewpoint, nor can ordinary biographers comprehend the significance and meaning of the life of a pure devotee of God. Were such persons to objectively study the life of Prabhupada, the esoteric meanings would evade them. Were they to charitably try to praise Prabhupada, they would not know how. So, when Prabhupada gave permission, he said it should be done transcendentally and in parampara. So the non-devotee is, in a certain important sense, disqualified. Although that opinion is there, like the word authorized biography to us that means, you know, bona fide, but to non-devotees that means, oh, this is a safe biography, it's not getting into the real dirt about this person, because somebody who was trusted to write it, who's going to praise him, was asked to write it by the estate or by the institution, so you're not going to find the real story here, because it's authorized. But yes, Krishna.
Well, the statement by that person you quoted, it seems very appropriate for a politician, because he's such a controversial person, but Prabhupada's not really controversial,
right.
And so it's just a matter of it being factual.
Hmm. So a non-devotee, so-called non-devotee, he could do it, but he'd have to like attain to a lot of appreciation, as apparently that, to give that example, that Charles Brooks did. As he studied and studied and studied, he never became like an initiated devotee, but he began to get a real deep appreciation. Then he could grasp it. Otherwise, it would be like licking the outside of the bottle of honey. Yes.
Also, the Lilamrita has reviews by scholars saying that it's such a good or great work. That could be used as that the scholars are saying it's objective and well written, even though it is by a devotee.
Yeah. Yeah, as Ganeshakti said, yes, it could be that devotees would be biased. But if the scholars say that it was, that it isn't, that it's to be read, then that's important. In fact, that's what that Choice magazine said. He author writes with both sympathy and balance. So they knew, well, this is a devotee, a follower of Prabhupada is writing the book. But he's taken trouble to show different sides. So that's part of our duty when we write these different things. Yes?
What would you say about a biographer having to be... I noticed with Amrita that the biographer, the author, is kind of... I knew that you wrote it, but when I was reading it, kind of like the author kind of disappears, becomes invisible. And all you see is Prabhupada. And that was just the wonder of reading Amrita, was that although I knew you had written it, I didn't... It was so transparent that... Couldn't really see, there wasn't, you couldn't see an author steering things for his own purpose. I don't know if you can understand what I'm saying.
Oh, sure, I can.
I mean, I know you can. And is it clear what I'm saying?
All right, so give these out. And thank you for all the nights you've been writing these questions and listening. I said this was a warm-up, but I can't imagine a better audience in Vrindavan. I think Vrindavan may be anti-climax. So, some question about that you think would be good for a group about Prabhupada Lilamrita. I'll tell you, I confess, the fear I have about this particular class is that it'll be too... I'm talking about myself, and especially in Vrindavan, it's not going to be just my disciples or friends, that I think they may think, well, he's just talking about himself. Where's the appreciation of Prabhupada? So the more that I can bring out Prabhupada, although talking about the Prabhupada Lilamrita, that will be good, I think. Therefore, if you can think of questions that will bring that focus there, that will help assure that this class is... really about appreciating Prabhupada through this biography. Someone asked, what about remembering Srila Prabhupada? Could some passages be read of either or both? Remembering Srila Prabhupada. Yeah, I meant to read a little bit from the introduction at least. Maybe some other parts. That's a good, nice suggestion. Someone asked if if anyone else is writing biographies of Prabhupada except for devotees. I don't know of anyone. But I had a question that I'd written down for group discussion, which was, will there be any other biographies of Prabhupada? And I said, yes, there will be. Garuda was saying that he thought I had really covered the field, so that if and when people do write biographies, they're going to have to go to this, and so that will be very good for shaping the future ones. They can't just put this aside and then write some bogus thing about Prabhupada being a businessman or something. They have to deal with this and all the documentation. It'll help to shape, even if in the future they do start writing some biographies.
Lamar?
Yeah.
Isn't that book Hare Krishna Explosion by Hare Griva, isn't that kind of like a biography?
Yeah. Yeah, that is. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj's play is kind of like that.
It seems like Life of the Perfect Master is also a, you'd say, a biographical supplement. But it seems to be like written in such a way that it's, I guess, maybe like a Hare Krishna Explosion. It's like it's a particular person's experience.
Yeah, I think it's called memoir, to put it into the category. They're memoirs of being with the great person. And it would really be nice when a lot of books like that, those people who had that association, in a sense they have a responsibility. I'm going to meet Giriraj Swami this summer. He keeps saying he's going to write, but he doesn't. I'm going to try to encourage him. So there'll be a whole library of memoirs and biographies and columns. Yeah, those books are like written from one person's viewpoint. And they're limited in that way, but they have their own nectar. You mentioned certain techniques of biographical authors, especially modern ones. Can one recognize such traits within the techniques used by medieval authors, such as Krishnadas Kaviraj or Vrindavan Das Thakur, etc.? Well, the non-devotees, I'm not sure how they would approach those books. I don't think I would want to know. But we regard them as scriptures. It's like Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's one of the scriptures, like the scriptures written by Vyasadeva. Remember, I went to a class with... And Edward Dimmock was teaching. He's the man who wrote the introduction to Bhagavad Gita. And he's an expert. His field is Bengali literature. And so he said, in Murari Gupta's diaries, he said, there's no mention that when Lord Chaitanya appeared as a boar incarnation, he actually manifested himself as a boar, but just that he manifested some symptoms. But I see here in the picture of your book that you have Lord Chaitanya as a boar. And so I am answered that we, whatever is stated in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we don't have to compare that with anything else. We don't question it. We accept that as scriptures. The transcendental author of Chaitanya Charitamrita is regarded by us as like another Vyasadeva. So whether they would call it hagiography, I don't know. But that's, you could say, well, then why didn't you do that in Prabhupada Lilamrita? Because I thought that I can't write scripture like that, which they write from that viewpoint. There's another reason why I wrote a modern biography. because it's something I could actually write. Well, now the kind of writing we see in the modern days, the only other kind of writing we call this flowery Gaudiya Math writing. I really can't stand that. If you read the book The Ray of Vishnu by Rupa Vilas, you can read it, but the book that he drew a lot of the material from, it's just it's so flowery the way they write. It's very hard to read it. Rupa Vilas said it's like they're trying to deliberately kill the reader's interest the way they so that's another type of writing. But no, the books that you mentioned, they're divine literatures. On Sankirtan, I was distributing Prabhupada books and was considering trying another book because of the constant rejection. I decided to approach one more person with it. He said that this was just a book he'd been waiting for. He said he didn't agree with the religion, but that he loves this guy. He gave me $5 and encouraged me to always sell these Prabhupada books. All right. Did you write that? Question. Just as CC was written by KDK, elaborating on incidents not detailed in Vrindavan Das Chaitanya Bhagavat, could another book be written detailing pastimes not fully detailed in Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, such as Srila Prabhupada Lila books? Several female disciples of Prabhupada, Janava, Mahamaya, and Angamanjari, have told me they have good stories about Prabhupada that weren't used in Prabhupada Lila or Prabhupada Nectar. Yeah, there's more that could be done. I think the best place, or the easiest place for it, is the Prabhupada Nectar. We can just take one anecdote after another. But like anything else, it takes manpower and money, and kind of ran out.